It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. There are good ideas, bad ideas, and then there are dangerous ideas.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
I said I wish I'd never been born.
I'd rather not have existed.
Dangerous
ideas. Sex.
A billion husbands are about to be replaced.
Oh. Oh.
The intellectual thrill ride of the year.
Dangerous
ideas.
So what makes an idea dangerous? It could kill people. The atom bomb was certainly a dangerous idea. It could unleash people. Think of what voting rights and vibrators did for women. Or it could just challenge conventional wisdom. Over the past year, we've aired dozens of dangerous ideas from contributors. Today, we're going to hear some of yours. But first, a few years back, Harvard's rock star cognitive psychologist Steven Pinker suggested asking a whole bunch of leading scientists and thinkers one question. What is your dangerous idea? The BBC Radio described it as the crack cocaine of the thinking world.
There's a question of what makes ideas objectively dangerous and what makes ideas come to be perceived as dangerous. Obviously, dangerous ideas include things like tips for making massively destructive weapons or ideologies that demonize or dehumanize an ethnic group or race. Those clearly can be dangerous. We know that parts of the world where people have lived in comedy for decades or centuries can erupt in pogroms or genocides if someone starts to spread the idea that one group is morally responsible for all of the troubles experienced by another. Mm-hmm. So some ideas are objectively dangerous. That is, they can lead in a short number of steps to concrete harm.
Right.
Others are perceived to be dangerous if they are unorthodox, if they challenge received wisdom or widely accepted dogma. And so they often elicit the same reaction in people, even if their only threat is to egos or received wisdom. Mm.
And often those ideas are phrased in the form of a question that, as you said, challenges the status quo or received wisdom. Can you give us a few examples?
Oh, is the distribution of mathematical ability between men and women identical, to pick one that has had recent real-world consequences? Are the events narrated in the Bible fictitious? Not just the miracles, but the ancient empires or even the existence of figures like Moses and, for that matter, Jesus?
Yeah, that'll make a lot of people mad.
Yes. How severely are children traumatized by sexual abuse? Would the world be a better place if prostitution were legalized? Is homosexuality transmitted by a pathogen like an infectious disease?
So, Stephen, there were times in history when coming up with a dangerous idea like this could get you killed or imprisoned. I mean, I was thinking about, you know, Galileo, Copernicus, Martin Luther. Looking back, what are some of the most influential dangerous ideas in history?
The theory of evolution is an obvious one. I think the rise of neuroscience with the idea that the mind consists of the physiological activity of the brain rather than from an immortal soul would be another. The idea that kings and other authorities are fallible and may be challenged and don't have the divinely mandated right to rule. The legitimacy of practices such as slavery and public torture executions were considered dangerous in their day.
And so what's interesting is these are all ideas that we now take for granted, but were dangerous in their day. And they're all ideas that advanced civilization in some way or another. I'm wondering, could you argue that civilization in general advances thanks to dangerous ideas? I mean, that almost every revolutionary or life-changing idea or inspiration was originally perceived to be dangerous.
That would be a matter for historians of ideas. So I don't know if that's true of all of them, but it is certainly true of a lot of them.
Yeah, I was thinking about evolution for sure. But even, you know, if you move to art history, Impressionism. People were originally shocked by the first Impressionist paintings and thought they were terrible and, you know, shouldn't be seen.
That is true, and we can add many advances in medicine, which in their time were considered morally troubling, if not shocking.
Really? Like what?
Well, the idea of a blood transfusion, that you would actually would seem to be tampering with the essence of a person by introducing this alien life essence of the blood of another person. It was considered to be violating a boundary, a sacred boundary of nature. Mm. Vaccination, even more so. I mean, the idea of putting pus from a cow in the, under your skin was considered to be a violation of the natural order.
Well, would you put it that way?
Yeah. Anesthesia was considered to be undermining the ability to suffer, which God implanted in us in order to be aware of our own mortality and vulnerability. Artificial insemination was considered to be an abomination when it was introduced in the 1950s. And not so long ago, in vitro fertilization was considered to open the door to a brave new world and to the kind of a Promethean control over the natural process of human reproduction. Now, it's hard to see what the fuss was about for any of these practices. Life insurance, believe it or not, was considered to be a dangerous idea because a woman was betting that her husband would die. Mm. And it took the life insurance companies a campaign of linguistic reframing that, no, you're not betting that your husband will die, although literally that's what you're doing when you take out life insurance. Rather, it is a responsible husband caring for his family even after he's dead. And when you think about the same concept in different terms, the taboo can evaporate.
You know what's really interesting is listening to you run through all of those. Those were all once considered dangerous ideas. Today, we accept them, which makes you wonder, maybe every dangerous idea that we hear about today, we should just be accepting.
No, I would not go that far, because while it may be true that many ideas that turn out to be true or commendable were denounced as dangerous in their time, the converse doesn't hold. It's not that every idea that's denounced as dangerous will turn out to be true or advisable. There are crackpot ideas. There are toxic ideas. So the question is not that if it's outrageous, then it must be true. Rather, that ideas have to be considered because our first intuition as to whether they're dangerous or not may be mistaken. Mm. And it's only by airing and examining an idea that you can determine whether it is true or advisable on the one hand or false and objectively dangerous on the other.
I was trying to think of what might be a dangerous idea today. I was thinking, okay, how about the idea that it would be a good idea for us to eventually download some of our intelligence into computers, our cognitive abilities into computers, so that we could sort of merge with computers and, you know, become immortal in that way. A lot of people would think that's a terrible, terrible idea. I don't know. Maybe it just seems dangerous to us now, and in another 50 years, it'll seem like a no-brainer.
Possibly, although that's not one that has aroused moralistic opposition. You don't see it denounced. You don't see the people who discuss it being demonized or vilified or punished. So I would distinguish between ideas that are, you know, controversial, not immediately accepted, and those that are perceived as dangerous in the sense of being denounced on moral grounds. Mm. And so there have been, to be fair, there was a book published in the 1970s by Joseph Weizenbaum, Computer Power and Human Reason, that argued that that artificial intelligence was morally troubling, if not dangerous. But since then, it hasn't been the kind of thing that brings picketers outside your lecture hall or campaigns to silence or muzzle or punish you, whereas there are other ideas that really have, that really drive people out of office and that make them radioactive thereafter.
Though I was going to say that at least today, we don't put people to death for their ideas. You know, we just cancel their grants.
Yes, that's a significant advance. There are parts of the world, and particularly in the Muslim world, where expressing heterodox ideas can get you assassinated or imprisoned.
Yeah.
But it's a shrinking portion of the world.
So would you make the case that you can evaluate a culture's success or failure, strength or weakness based on its willingness to tolerate dangerous ideas? In other words, is it a good thing if a culture is more tolerant of dangerous ideas?
Oh, absolutely, because you don't really know whether an idea will be dangerous until it is aired and examined and debated. Cultures in which ideas are suppressed before they can be aired will inevitably stagnate. the ideal are, and the cultures that we've enjoyed living in, the democracies, the humane democracies, are ones in which opinions can be expressed, and it doesn't mean they have to be accepted. It doesn't mean that someone has to listen, still less than they have to be accepted. But cultures in which you are not thrown in jail, you're not killed, you're not driven out of town for expressing an idea, are those in which the best ideas can rise and become accepted in the long run.
Mm. It sounds to me like part of what you're talking about has to do with a habit of mind or frames of mind. And we all find ourselves going through a lot of life without really, I guess, thinking inside certain patterns. Is there anything you do yourself personally to try to make sure you continue to, I don't know, question limits, boundaries, status quo, make yourself think more dangerously?
Oh, absolutely. Namely to, and of course, no one thinks that their own ideas are dangerous, except in the new hip sense of dangerous as a good thing, but objectively dangerous.
Right.
And so the important thing is to force yourself to read as open-mindedly as possible and listen to as open-mindedly as possible ideas and people you don't like, those that criticize you, those that advance ideas that you're not happy with. Now, this is emotionally unpleasant. It's not fun to read criticisms of yourself or to read proponents of ideas that you don't particularly like. But if you are to be a fair-minded and effective thinker or scientist or even an informed and intelligent layperson, then you have to be open to the other side, even if to just understand what their opinion is. Now, and I personally adopt strategies of self-management so that I don't always postpone the unpleasant task of reading opinions that I disagree with. If I have to read, say, a negative review of one of my books or a criticism, you know, I might do it on a long plane flight where I'm already miserable and uncomfortable and strapped into a tiny seat, and so how much worse can it get? But I do carve out times in my life when I will face the unpleasant chore of entertaining ideas that I don't particularly like. I think you identified just intellectual inertia and laziness as one of the causes of walling ourselves off from dangerous ideas. But I think the greater risk is moralization, the idea that certain people or certain ideas are inherently evil and we must denounce them and give them as little airtime as possible. Overcoming that tendency, a very human tendency, of assuming that anyone who disagrees with you is stupid or evil, I think is an essential part of being a fair-minded person. I think it ought to be encouraged in schools, particularly in universities, in newspapers, in internet forums. It doesn't mean that everything has to be accepted. It just means that one should always be open to the possibility that one's first response is going to be to demonize ideas that one doesn't agree with.
Steven Pinker is a cognitive psychologist and the author of many books. He's a contributor to and inspiration for John Brockman's anthology called What is Your Dangerous Idea?
Hello, my name is Bill Lohman, and I listen to TT Book on WFSU Radio in Tallahassee, Florida. My dangerous idea is that historically black colleges and universities need to be one of the lead agencies that will define and defend African humanity. For the last 40 years, I have been a practitioner of the Lukumi Afro-Cuban spiritual tradition. As a result of many profound experiences, I have come to realize that one of the most critical issues black people face today is the need to understand that we are African people. The legacy of slavery and colonialism has left us decimated from cultural and mental genocide. Historically, black colleges and universities need to be one of the lead agencies that will define and defend African humanity. The dialogue must be moved beyond the false dichotomy of segregation versus integration and the lie of race as a meaningful definition of human life. HBCUs have done and continue to do miraculous work in spite of enormous opposition and criminal underfunding. Historically, black colleges and universities exist within a context of white social control. The social contract under which HBCUs were created was one of extreme duress, characterized by the betrayal of post-Reconstruction politics and the terrorism of Jim Crow. The very idea of restoring black people to authentic Africanity at the time most HBCUs were established was equivalent to madness. HBCUs still do not reflect the true needs of African people in recovery from the monstrous crime of global slavery. HBCUs reflect a white aesthetic that denies any significant loss by African people. Because of this limitation, they are not currently organized to meet the true needs of black people as an autonomous African people. We have been taught to believe that tens of thousands of years of our history prior to the horrors of slavery are inconsequential and have no value or voice to inform our current situation. It is our human right to educate and socialize our children in our own image and interest. We must reframe the mission of HBCUs in order to provide an educational experience that places black African people in the center of their own existence for as long as the sun shines and the rivers flow.
That's listener Bill Lohman with his dangerous idea. Have you ever had one of those really bad days where you question the meaning of your life? Well, coming up, a dangerous idea takes that thought to a whole new mind-blowing level. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about dangerous ideas today. Do you remember that scene in It's a Wonderful Life when Jimmy Stewart, playing George Bailey, is at his lowest low? He's standing on a bridge contemplating suicide, and then his guardian angel, Clarence, jumps into the ice-cold water, and George winds up saving Clarence's life instead of ending his own. But then later, while they're warming up, that's when George famously says he wishes he'd never been born. Of course, by the end of the movie, George has changed his mind and everybody's happy. But philosopher David Benatar is made of tougher stuff. He thinks George was right the first time. It really would be better not to have been born. Benatar is the author of Better Never to Have Been, The Harm of Coming into Existence. Steve Paulson wanted to know if he really means it.
David, the dedication of your book almost reads like a Jonathan Swift satire. It says, "To my parents, even though they brought me into existence, and to my brothers, each of whose existence, although a harm to him, is a great benefit to the rest of us." But you're really serious about this idea, aren't you? That we'd be better off if we'd never been born?
Absolutely. I'm completely serious.
Why?
There are many arguments, I think, for that conclusion. One of them is a more technical kind of argument. It's about an asymmetry between the good things in life and the bad things. I recognize that life contains both in varying proportions for different people, but I think that there's a difference in that the bad things in life are a reason not to bring people into existence, whereas the good things in life are not a reason to bring them into existence. And that's because the absence of good things is only bad if there's somebody who's thereby deprived. So if there's nobody there who's missing out on pleasures, for example, or other good things in life, that's not something that's bad.
And you're saying that, on the other hand, by definition, coming into life is bad because there will be pain? People will suffer pain?
Yes. So the effect of that is that so long as a life will contain some bad in it, there's a net harm to coming into existence. Now, I don't think that that argument by itself shows that it's wrong to have children, for example. I think it does show that it's a harm, but it might be a negligible harm. And that's why we come to my next argument, which is one about the relative balances of good and bad in a life. And there I think we tend to radically underestimate the amount of bad that there is. And so I point to ample psychological literature which shows that humans have this bias towards optimism, that they tend to underestimate the amount of bad there is in life. And then I go through various theories that say something about what it is for a life to be good. And I show how in all those theories, there's actually much more bad in our lives than we would like to think.
Wait, so you're saying if you were to add up all the bad stuff in our lives and all the good stuff in our lives, the bad column would far outstrip the good column?
Yes.
Okay, you're gonna have to explain this. That's not obvious.
It's not obvious, no. I think what we need to recognize here, though, is there are two different contexts in which you can make this calculation. The one is for somebody who already exists, and the other is for somebody who you're thinking about bringing into existence. Now, if you're speaking about somebody who already exists, that person has an interest in continuing to exist. And so if you're making a judgment about whether their life is worth continuing, you're going to need to have stronger defeater conditions. In other words, there's going to need to be stronger reasons to override the interest in continuing to exist. And that, I think, happens in situations where life has become so unbearable that euthanasia or assisted suicide or something of that kind is something we should think about. But my interest is not in that. It's in situations where we're contemplating bringing somebody into existence. Now, if somebody is not existing yet, and they may never exist, they have no interest in coming into existence. And so we don't need as much to defeat the harms that they will suffer.
This is an argument basically never to have children.
Yes. If you combine these arguments together, it's that we ought never to have children. And I know that's a radical idea, and I know that it violates every biological impulse that people have, but that's exactly why I think we need to step back, because those biological impulses are not necessarily rationally informed. They have deep evolutionary origins. They're certainly pre-rational beings that are not rational, beings that are not even sentient, have those drives in some form or another to reproduce. And I think we need to just step back and say, what's this all about? Is this all appropriate?
Well, okay, well, let's step back then. What makes you say that the bad stuff outweighs the good stuff in our lives?
There are lots of asymmetries between the good things and the bad things. So let me give you a thought experiment. Let's imagine that I could offer you an hour of the most sublime pleasures that you could imagine in exchange for 30 minutes of the most outrageous torture. Is that something that you would accept?
No, I wouldn't. But then that's not my actual life. I mean, I hope I am not in a position where I would ever have to deal with that awful torture.
But what the thought experiment is intended to show is that if you wanted to have pleasures, let's say for an hour, the most sublime pleasures that you can imagine, you wouldn't have those, you wouldn't go for those, you wouldn't voluntarily accept them if it would involve even half an hour, even 5 minutes, I imagine, or 10 minutes of the most excruciating torture. And what that suggests, I think, is that the worst pains are worse than the best pleasures are good.
Okay, I would grant you that. You know, there is another argument that I would guess has deep philosophical roots and as well as religious roots, and that's that part of what life is about, part of what makes it meaningful, is that, yeah, there is suffering, but you got to go through it. And, you know, by dealing with it, but in a profound way, you will find more meaning. And you can often come out the other side of it. And actually, life is richer at that point.
Well, again, if that is true, that's true for existing people. So would we go out of our way now to create new people who can now have the suffering so that their lives can have meaning? If they don't exist, they don't need meaning in their lives. If you take your argument too far, then it might in fact be an argument for inflicting suffering, because you'll say it's something to grapple with, to wrestle with, to give your life meaning. And that again sounds to me like a sort of indecent view.
Okay, I want to come back to this question of whether to have children or not. Obviously, you're saying it's philosophically, it makes more sense not to have children. What about if someone's pregnant? Are you saying the fetus should be aborted?
Well, it depends. So if you combine my view with certain views about fetal moral status, that is to say the moral status of a fetus, then it might imply that you ought to abort at the early stages of gestation. I think at the later stages of gestation, once you've got a sentient fetus, then the fetus has actually already started to exist in the relevant sense, and then abortion may be problematic. But if you're dealing with a pre-sentient fetus, and you say, well, look, in the relevant sense, it hasn't begun existing, then this might imply that you ought to abort, that the morally preferable thing would be to abort. But that's a separate view from the antinatalist view. You have to combine antinatalism with some views of fetal moral status in order to generate what I call the pro-death view on abortion. It doesn't follow automatically. It has to be combined.
Hmm. I take it that you do not have any children yourself.
That's a personal question, and I don't think the strength of my arguments should rest on whether I am a hypocrite or not.
I think that's highly relevant. It sounds like maybe you do have children.
No, I believe these are my own arguments, and I act on them.
Wait, you won't answer the question then?
Well, I don't have children, but I don't think that's whether I have children or not is relevant to the strength of the argument.
Okay. No, I mean that. Thank you. Thank you for answering.
I mean, the reason why I'm resistant to answering it was I think people get distracted by a personal detail that I don't think is relevant.
Okay. Would you describe yourself as, just personally, as more of an optimist or a pessimist?
I don't think one can make those categorical statements because I think there's some things that we have reason to be optimistic about. I have a reason to be optimistic about my chances of surviving until tomorrow. I do not have good reason to be optimistic about my chances of surviving to live to the age of 120 or 150. So I don't think one can just categorically describe oneself as an optimist or a pessimist. One has to ask, what are you optimistic or pessimistic about? And then ask whether optimism or pessimism in that area is warranted or not.
Okay, let me rephrase the question slightly. Would you describe yourself generally as an upbeat person, as a happy person?
Another one of those personal questions.
That's right. Well, I think that's relevant. Because I'm not sure that you can deal with this at strictly a philosophical level. It seems that we're talking about quality of life, and there's something profoundly subjective about that.
Well, I don't want to get too personal here, but perhaps I should just say that lots of people who know me have difficulty believing that I actually hold these views. But I do hold them.
Okay, I'm going to ask another personal question because I think it is highly relevant here. Do you wish you had not been born? Would you rather not exist?
Yes. I'd rather not have existed. That's different from would I rather be dead.
Right. Do you think about that much?
Yes. I think we all should. Now, some people might say that's crying over spilt milk, but there are prospective benefits to be gained here, because I think if you have a certain sensitivity to the way the world is and to the amount of suffering that there is in the world, not just your own, but other people's, then you might think twice about having children, about participating in a culture that encourages people to have children, that frowns on people who don't. So I think there's something to be gained from thinking about these things.
David Benatar is the author of Better Never to Have Been, The Harm of Coming into Existence. He talked with Steve Paulson.
I'm Katha Pollitt. My new book is called Pro, Reclaiming Abortion Rights. And my dangerous idea is your child is not a special snowflake. Helicopter parents are everywhere if you trust the media. They hover over their precious sons and daughters and make sure they have the best of everything, from organic baby food to special tutors to help with their college applications. If their child is not getting the right kind of attention and nurture in school or after school or camp, those parents march right down to the principal. If the school budget is cut, these parents raise money so their kids can still have art and music and guidance counselors. Well, you say, what's wrong with that? Nothing's too good for our children. No. In America today, what too many middle-class parents really think is that nothing's too good for their own children. Those other children are out of luck and out of sight. As inequality increases, the children of prosperous parents are living better than ever before, with more opportunities to grow and learn and prepare themselves for adulthood. Less fortunate children are increasingly being left behind. The U.S. is still the richest country in the world, but one in five children are growing up poor. That's the highest child poverty rate in the developed world, about the same as, get this, Romania's. Poor children get less of everything kids need to grow up to be happy and productive adults. They get less quality medical care and go to schools that do not have the resources to make up for parental poverty. They live in substandard housing in neighborhoods that are dangerous and polluted. Their parents are too often stressed and overwhelmed, and that means the kids suffer too. If those children go to college and their chances of getting there are low, the odds that they can stay there are not good. Even public universities that used to be free or nearly free can cost a bundle now, and many students need to interrupt their education to work to help out their families. So what if, instead of just narrowly focusing on our own children, we middle-class parents raised our sights a bit and did what needs to be done so that all kids have what our own kids do? Yes, it might involve raising taxes. It might mean extending lots more help to single mothers. It might mean returning to unfashionable ideas like, oh, I don't know, racially integrating our schools. In return, we would have a better, stronger country in which lots more kids got to become their best selves and contribute to the well-being of society, which means the well-being of everyone. The truth is, your child is not a special snowflake. She's a snowflake. And that is pretty special. But what about all the other snowflakes out there? Aren't they just as special? Aren't they?
That's Katha Pollitt with her dangerous idea. By the way, you can find more dangerous ideas on our website at ttbook.org, and you can hear more coming up in just a few minutes, including Chuck Palahniuk's new literary genre called Gonzo Erotica. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Hi, everybody. My name is Ben Riggs. I am a regular TT Book listener on the internet. I also have my own podcast called Plot Points and another one called The Hyperculture, and I am here to share with you today a dangerous idea, which is that humble little tabletop role-playing games represent the most significant development in the history of myth in perhaps centuries. I know that's a bold statement, but hear me out. If you don't know what a tabletop role-playing game is, it's like Dungeons & Dragons. Each player is given a character. One player, the Game Master, represents the world these characters inhabit. Now, together they tell stories, so players gather at a table and role-play their characters, hence the name tabletop role-playing game. Now, tabletop role-playing games are important because instead of people hearing myths around a fire from a storyteller or hearing them from a pulpit on Sunday, gamers are creating their own communal myths to make sense of their lives. And it's this communal creative aspect that really makes gaming significant and, frankly, a revolutionary phenomenon. For thousands and thousands of years, myths were subject to the control of nation-states. In Egypt and Rome, mythology turned in total subservience to the government because myth and story were seen as so important that they couldn't be left to the common people. This was the way of things for much of recorded history, with Romans sicking lions on Christians for mythology not in line with that of the state, which was followed by Christians burning pagans at the stake for the same crime. Mythology and stories were left in control of the state until the Protestant Reformation, which essentially opened the floodgates in Europe, with Martin Luther's very punk rock affirmation that any person can, when guided by the Holy Spirit, make their own interpretation of Scripture. Professor of mythology Joseph Campbell says, "Millenniums have rolled by, with only minor variations played on stories and themes derived from God knows when. But a galaxy of mythologies must be taken into account in any study of the spectacle of our own titanic age." Now, if Joseph Campbell was shown what the geeks and nerds that gather at my dining room table do on a Sunday night, in his terms, he might describe it as a private, communal rite in which personal experiences are hewn into a story that has meaning, possibly only for the individuals at the gaming table, but meaning nonetheless. Tabletop role-playing games represent the ultimate democratization of myth creation. Forces once controlled by the state, under pain of death, are now at the beck and call of anyone with a handful of dice and a rulebook. Now, the freedom of a person to more or less tell their own story without the interference of government or religion is not necessarily a new one, but gaming is a radical institution because it allows everyone, not just artists or ivory tower, Ivy League upper crusts, to engage in myth creation. There is no gatekeeper. Gaming is an institution which teaches people to do what was once the sole prerogative of the priests of Amun-Ra or the emperors of Rome, to make their own meaningful stories.
That's listener Ben Riggs from Milwaukee with his dangerous idea. Chuck Palahniuk has made a lot of money turning dangerous ideas into fiction. He's probably best known for the novel and the movie Fight Club, but even his readings can be dangerous. When he was on book tour in the early 2000s, he used to read a short story called Guts. And believe me, you don't want the gory details, but it's about accidents involving masturbation. Over the years, 73 people have fainted while hearing him read that story. Well, now Chuck Palahniuk is back with a new novel called Beautiful You. True to form, there's a dangerous idea at the heart of it. It's about a guy who invented the greatest sex toys the world has ever known. Here's one scene.
The television showed a group of delighted, smiling young women gathered around a table. In the center of the shot, the prettiest of them blew out the candles on a birthday cake as her friends pressed gifts upon her. To comic effect, every gift turned out to be a bright pink box emblazoned with a very curly-cued white logo, Beautiful You. The girls rolled their shoulders and giggled, as if sharing some glorious secret. They pursed their lips and leaned to whisper in one another's ears. The birthday girl squealed as if the pink boxes contained nirvana. To Penny, it was unlikely that girls like these, thin, doe-eyed, clear-skinned, would have any problem finding men who'd romance them. They were the last women who'd need to buy Maxwell's throbbing whatchamacallits. Suddenly, Penny envisioned a billion lonely wives or single women abusing themselves in isolated resignation. In ghetto tenements or tumble-down farmhouses, not bothering to meet potential partners, living and dying with no intimate companions beyond their Beautiful You gadgetry.
Instead of being either whores or Madonnas, they'd become celibates who diddled a lot. To Penny, that didn't seem like social progress. The television commercial ended with the familiar tagline, a dulcet female voice intoned, "A billion husbands are about to be replaced."
Chuck, what inspired you to write Beautiful You?
You know, I wanted to write a comedy about arousal addiction because it's such a big topic right now. Nobody can talk about it directly. And so the way that Ira Levin wrote about abortion and women's reproductive rights and Rosemary's Baby and wrote about the backlash against feminism in Stepford Wives, I wanted to create a kind of benign metaphor through which we could talk about arousal addiction.
You wanted to invent this whole new genre.
I did. I was really trying to invent something I called gonzo erotica, which is an erotic book that is not at all especially sexy, that right at the point where it should sort of arouse you, it arrives at the wrong word and has a kind of comic effect. And so often the beginning writers that I work with will do that. They'll tackle a topic that is really profound, usually their own abuse as a child, but they'll write about it in such a poor way that it turns out to be inadvertently funny. And so I wanted to write erotica that was inadvertently funny.
Yeah, and you definitely did that. Can you give me a brief synopsis of what happens in Beautiful You without, of course, revealing too many spoilers?
Beautiful You, it's about a young woman who is just graduated from law school. She does not especially want to be a lawyer. And in a way, she feels like politically she's being kind of driven into a profession like law or medicine or science because that's what feminists want of her at this stage in history, even though it's not something that she herself is attracted to. What she wants, what she dreams of, is holding some form of power, but it's a power that's kind of beyond a political power. It's a much more kind of rudimentary power over human beings. And so that's what she gets as she is first gradually seduced by a wealthy man and then comes to gain her own power through a learned teacher on Mount Everest. And then she comes back and she challenges the wealthy man and is able to defeat him and gains the power she always dreamed of.
Can you tell me a bit about the wealthy man, this software mega-billionaire named C. Linus Maxwell, and how the title Beautiful You figures into the storyline?
C. Linus Maxwell is the stereotypical, straw-stuffed, two-dimensional character that is in so many women's novels, that wealthy man who comes in and sweeps the kind of plain Jane woman off her feet. But in this case, he's known as a kind of sexual expert. He spent most of his adult life studying sexual techniques, and he has used these techniques to create a line of sex toys, personal care products, that he eventually ends up testing on our heroine, Penny Harrigan.
Yeah. It struck me, Beautiful You, struck me a bit as kind of 50 Shades of Grey meets Brave New World. Is that what you were going for?
Yeah, I'll settle for that one.
But, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. You've said that you're fascinated by low fiction that disgusts the reader or makes them sexually aroused. Why?
Well, I think we kind of divide fiction between low fiction, which excites or stimulates the reader in some way, like science fiction or horror or erotica, and high culture fiction, which, I don't know, brings the reader to a higher enlightenment. And I kind of argue that I'd like to see a little bit of both. I thought that so much of Ira Levin's work was low fiction, but it dealt with issues far more effectively than most high culture fiction did.
You've described gonzo erotica, this new genre you've invented with Beautiful You, as being sex writing that is not in the slightest bit sexy or arousing. So I'm curious, is the reader of Beautiful You supposed to find the novel titillating or shocking or both?
I would hope that they would sort of stumble along these erotica sentences until they get to that last word, which is so totally clunky and inappropriate that it makes them laugh, or is a moment of shock that makes them laugh. Another writer that I greatly admire is Kurt Vonnegut, and he dealt with so many issues, but regardless of the depth of the issue, he was still dismissed as a science fiction writer. And so again, you know, I think these low culture writers deserve a greater recognition.
Yeah. Your novels take very dangerous ideas as their premises, and I'm wondering how much of this was influenced by the course that you took from Tom Spanbauer.
You know, Tom taught that there was no guarantee that you would ever sell your work, that you would ever get any kind of a reward beyond the pleasure of the writing. So the writing itself should be an exploration of your own deepest anxieties, you know, within some sort of a masked metaphor that allowed you to really unpack and to seduce yourself into exploring issues you'd never consciously choose to go into. And that's what made it dangerous. It really was you on the page in some way. And so that's what I am doing. But in this case, it is arousal addiction within the metaphor of sex toys.
Yeah. So what are the key elements of dangerous writing? You explained what it is, but there are certain kind of rules or guidelines that you follow?
You might be confusing dangerous writing with a style called minimalism that Tom teaches. And it was a style that he learned from Gordon Lish at Columbia. And minimalism has a million rules regarding not using abstracts, not using adverbs, breaking everything down, not using any kind of received text. And I violate all of those rules in Beautiful You. Beautiful You is a complete travesty when it comes to minimalism. It's nothing but cliches.
You've experienced a lot of family tragedy in your life. Both your grandfather and your father had terrible ends to their lives. Would you mind telling me about that?
Oh, boy, the ends that we will go to sell a book. My grandfather, my Ukrainian grandfather, first-generation immigrant in the 1940s during World War II, possibly suffered a head injury, but came back from working in the shipyards and was very deranged and eventually ended up killing his wife, himself, and as many of the children in their family as he could find at the time. And my father only survived by hiding beneath a bed in their house and not coming as his father called for him. And then my father, at the age of 59, was dating a woman whose ex-husband ambushed them and shot and killed them both. So my father died at 59, the spring that the Fight Club movie was being released.
Wow, that's terrible. They eventually caught the man who killed his ex-wife as well as your father, right?
Right. He was caught and he was convicted of double murder. I was asked to give a victim statement, and it was uncomfortable because he was allowed to dismiss his counsel and act as his own counsel during that very last phase of the trial, and he did so. So I ended up on the stand making my victim statement, being cross-examined by the convicted killer of my father. It was a moment.
It must have been. The way you dealt with this was to start working on your novel, Lullaby.
Right. Lullaby was really the product of that. Choke was also a little bit of the product of my father's death.
How do you think these personal tragedies have affected your worldview and shaped you as a writer?
I think that there is nothing that heals us from events like this, that these events are so impossible to assimilate into our identity that we have to find some metaphorical story in which we can explore every aspect of the event, you know, through a metaphor, and that the real element is that it allows time to pass. It allows months or years to pass, and time itself is the only thing that resolves these things.
So does writing these novels, Lullaby and the other ones since then, is it cathartic? Is it a way of kind of coming to terms with all this tragedy that you've had to deal with?
It allows me to exhaust every aspect of my emotional reaction to the situation. So it is cathartic, and it does distract me.
Chuck Palahniuk is the author of Beautiful You. He talked with Doug Gordon. Palahniuk's just released a short story collection called Make Something Up, Stories You Can't Unread. And he's got a new graphic novel sequel to Fight Club called Fight Club 2. Oh, and there's also talk about turning Fight Club into a musical.
Hi, I'm Kate LaRiviere-Gagner. I listen to TT Book as a podcast. My dangerous idea is to have a reality show so that people can see what a day in the life of a teacher is like. I'm a fifth and sixth grade teacher in Vermont, and I wasn't always this way. I used to be a publicist working both in Vermont and the D.C. metro area. I became a teacher when I burned out on advertising and marketing, and I decided that I needed a job where I could have summers off. That was about 5 years ago, and I still have yet to see a summer off. A while back, I was watching the show Parenthood. The portrayal of the teacher and the principal by the show's writers really got me thinking. And it was then that I realized that very few people know what goes on in classrooms. Perceptions, I think, of the work that we do and people's expectations of us are pretty skewed and kind of inaccurate. People don't realize that for some kids, we are parents. We're their coach. We're their therapist. We're their counselor. We're nurses, social workers, supply chain managers, cooks, bakers, bottle washers, referees. Oh, yeah, and we have to teach them everything they need to know to be successful citizens in this country. As I said, my dangerous idea is to get a hold of Mark Burnett or somebody to turn teaching into a reality show, because people have to really find out what the day in the life of a teacher is like. And I know that for a lot of reasons, it's impossible to do this. There's confidentiality and safety issues that would mean that something in the vein of a true reality show is kind of off the table. But I'm hoping that my idea is dangerous enough to get people to pay better attention to the state of our schools and the lives of our educators. It's certainly been more than eye-opening for me to move from the private sector, where I worked for almost a decade, to the education sector and learn how parents and community members view teachers and the work that we do. And if you had asked me 10 or 15 years ago, I would have probably told you that teachers have it made. I was a summers off believer, and I even made the career change to prove it, but it was a cold shot of water to the face when I was handed the keys to my first classroom and learned what really was at stake and what I was responsible for. It's the majority of waking hours in 20 to 25, 10 and 11-year-old children's lives. When it comes down to it, between September and June, most kids are dealing with me more than they're dealing with their parents. People need to get a dose of a teacher's reality. In fact, even a true-to-life scripted show would force people to see what goes on when the bus leaves. And I think there's a lot we can all learn from that.
Thanks to listener Kate LaRivière-Gagner for sharing her dangerous idea with us. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Doug Gordon produced today's show with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Raymond Tungekar, and Craig Ely. Our theme music is by Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.